Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimbo.
Yes, hello and welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds, joined as ever by my partner from Sky Sports coverage of the NFL, Jeff Rimbo. Jeff, good morning. How are you doing, mate?
I'm doing good, man. It's early here and just getting ready to head to the office. But this opportunity to sit down and talk a little ball with you, always, Neil, is a pleasure.
All right, so we're going to look at some of the news from around the NFL because the franchise tag players did reach some long-term deals after we recorded last week's podcast. We're going to look at our 4-3 defensive ends. I think at the end of last week's podcast, I might have said we'd look at defensive tackles as well, but there's quite a bit of news that we want to get to this week. So we're going to focus on 4-3 defensive ends, and then we'll take your questions as ever in the mailbag. So, Jeff, let's start with the big deals that were signed by Dez Bryant with the Dallas Cowboys, 5 years, $70 million deal. Demaryius Thomas, same sort of numbers for the Denver Broncos at wide receiver. Stephen Gostkowski signed a 4 year, $17.2 million deal with the New England Patriots. Not bad money for a kicker. And Justin Houston signs the largest contract in Kansas City Chiefs history. 6 years, $101 million, makes him the highest paid linebacker in the NFL. I guess we'd really classify him as a pass rusher. But he's second in defensive players now behind Ndamukong Suh.
I think it's a great thing for every one of those guys, certainly. But I think it's a great thing for the fans of those clubs because now you're talking about franchise-level players that are insured long-term, and probably for each of those guys going to finish their career at that club. And, you know, that's good, Neil. I think it's good anytime the league can keep those name guys playing for a long time at the club. You know, this week was Brett Favre week, and, you know, it just, to me, the only thing that kind of stung a little bit as I watched that whole deal was to see that he didn't finish in Green Bay. You know, he ended up going to New York and then Minnesota and then called it a day. But, you know, I think when a guy can play his entire career for one team, I think that's special. And certainly for the fan base of those teams, I think it's a great, great thing.
Yeah, and I think we said last week, you know, the negotiation side of it is just the business aspect of the game. This did get me to look at I wanted to look at salaries for this upcoming season, Jeff. I thought it was interesting to take a look at that. And NFL.com had the top 20 salaries in terms of players and what they will earn in 2015. Now, Dez, you have to take it a little bit. It's not completely accurate in a way because Dez Bryant is due to make $3 million in 2015. And then there's a big signing bonus that's spread across his contract. But it was interesting to me that first of all, the top six guys are all quarterbacks. 15 of the 20 players on this list are quarterbacks. Aaron Rodgers is top at $22 million. Then you've got Ben Roethlisberger, Cam Newton, Matt Ryan, Joe Flacco, Drew Brees. Then you get the highest paid defensive player. It's Ndamukong Suh at $19 million for 2015. Then it's a bunch more quarterbacks. Kaepernick at $19 million. Cutler, $18.1 million. Romo, $18 million. Stafford, $17.6 million, Alex Smith, $17 million, Peyton Manning, $17 million. Then you get the second highest defensive player in the NFL. That's Justin Houston at $16.8 million. But he's number 14 overall. J.J. Watt is 15. Then you've got Carson Palmer, Eli Manning. Calvin Johnson is the only one who's not a defender or a quarterback. Mario Williams and Andy Dalton rounds out the top 20. And Jeff, I was just writing a story for the game program. For the Jets Dolphins, and I found this quote from Brent Grimes, and it was talking about completely different stuff, but he said it seems like the league doesn't really like defensive players that much. Well, those salaries would bear that out.
Yeah, well, you know what, the bottom line in the business of the NFL is that the most important position on the field is the quarterback.
Yeah.
And I think we've all seen what happens when you don't have one or yours gets hurt, and so those it's just simple supply and demand. If the demand is high and the supply is low, which it is, there's not, 32 of them to go around and 32 good ones to go around in the league. So the great players are going to command the biggest money. And I'm not surprised by those numbers, Neil. I defensive players should also, I'm sure they get you know, they have to deal with the fact that a lot of them get a lot of their money taken away by the league every year, you know, in fines for the way the rules are interpreted and enforced today. And, you know, you just got to realize that it's the nature of the game is now scoring. The nature of the game is throwing the football. It's moving the ball. That's what the fans want. That's what the league wants. And so the owners are going to pay what it takes to keep those, you know, elite level players, offensive players on their football teams.
Yeah, now our attention turns to Russell Wilson and what the Seahawks do with him and the San Diego Chargers and Phillip Rivers, because the Chargers have said, Jeff, that they are hoping to negotiate a new contract with Phillip Rivers before training camp begins. Well, some training camps open this coming weekend, and they're all open by next weekend. So that's an ambitious target for the Chargers to even think about getting a deal done before the start of the season. I think is going to be a big thing for them, because Phillip Rivers could play this out, Jeff. He could play this out because he's a free agent after in 2016. He's made it quite clear that he's not keen on an LA move. Well, that move to Los Angeles might come from the Chargers. Or is he being really clever, Jeff? Because if the Chargers move to LA, Rivers knows full well they need to have a franchise quarterback in place when they go to that big marquee city.
I think it's strategic the way that his agent has placed this thing. There's no rush to get a deal done, right? It's not like, you know, he can't afford to buy groceries this week. It's a situation of let the market show itself out. And I think, you know, it was interesting, kind of the Demaryius Thomas, you know, Dez Bryant situation, where they really weren't in a big hurry, per se, to get a deal done either side, because they wanted to see what the market... Once you get $18 million, well, that now becomes the floor for all negotiations beyond that. So I think the unsettled situation with L.A., I think the fact that, you know, Rivers is in the driver's seat, really, in the negotiations. And there's no reason to rush to get a deal done from his side, because he has another good year. He has more leverage than he has now. And so the players and those agents, they understand that, you know, they have really... they really have control at the bargaining table, and you know, there are very few times in a player's career that he's going to have control at the bargaining table. And these big second or third contracts are when they do, and that's where you see them exercise their right to put it on the clubs a little bit, if you will. I mean, Dez came out with that Wednesday deadline. He said, "If we don't have a deal by Wednesday, then I'm going to sit training camp and I'm going to sit regular season games." Well, that's a loaded gun to Jerry Jones's head now. And public sentiment can push an owner when it's that guy that is a fan favorite, that guy that's been the biggest offensive weapon that you have, that guy that arguably maybe, if not the best receiver in the game, he's one of the top receivers in the game. Well, you know, he's now established himself as the guy that has the control, or has the biggest stick when it comes down to the bargaining table.
Yeah, and I think, again, it goes back to this being business, Jeff. And I think before Chargers fans panic too much about their franchise quarterback, this is different from when they lost Ryan Matthews, when they lost Darren Sproles. Who knows what's going to happen with Eric Weddle? That could be a situation. But franchise quarterbacks rarely hit the market. You know, they rarely get out there. And Peyton Manning's was an exception, wasn't it, Jeff? It was he hadn't played in the best part of 500 days. I think he was four neck and shoulder operations. There was concern then, and Andrew Luck was waiting in the wings. That was a unique situation, but it doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, that's a really, really, it's almost a one-off because of the fact, as you mentioned, he had had the serious neck problem. He hadn't played. He was an advancing age. There were a lot of red flags, if you will, for clubs when you talked about a guy to go out and spend millions and millions of dollars on. So you're exactly right, Neil. You just don't see these guys get on the open market very much, because when they get on the open market, then the bidding war goes way higher, and it's much more fierce. And you know, you're sitting around as a franchise that needs a quarterback. For example, Buffalo, you talk about the Bills, you know, they're assembling, I think, a really, really fine roster up here. But the issue is, are they going to have enough quarterback play? The Jets, are they going to have enough quarterback play? Both of those teams have moved, in my opinion, to be in a position where, just from a pure roster standpoint, that they can now threaten New England for the AFC East. And, you know, the bottom line of it, though, is their quarterback play going to be enough to get them over the hump?
Yeah, it's always a concern when like you say, they've built such good rosters, but we're held back from, you know, anointing them as real playoff contenders until we know what they've got under center. We know what the Green Bay Packers had under center for many years before it was Aaron Rodgers, and Jeff alluded to it a few minutes ago. It was Brett Favre, who was inducted into Green Bay's Hall of Fame. Jeff, they said it was like a game day at Lambeau Field. People were tailgating outside in the parking lot. There were 67,000 people inside the stadium to pay tribute to number four. And part of me was thinking, why did they not do this around a game? But, I mean, I think they probably will honour him around a game. But, I mean, it might have been a massive distraction. If 67,000 people are showing up in July to pay tribute to Brett Favre, imagine what it would have been like during a regular season game. But I guess this is nice to see that coming together again, isn't it? Because it was a bitter divorce.
Well, I think the thing that was the best deal about it to me, and I understand why they did it in July from a marketing standpoint.
Yeah.
It gives you something to talk about, to anticipate the off season. It's a springboard into, you know, training camps, as you mentioned, opening next week, and an opportunity to really heal a wound, if you will, with one of your greatest players. And it was, to me, it was touching. I really, when he walked down the tunnel and that just sheer wall of noise, and he came out and the place was full, and you know, there was you know, just long enough away from him leaving and going to New York and Minnesota that the wounds healed, and I think that what people remembered when he walked out of that tunnel were all of those great plays and tremendous wins he had in Green Bay, and certainly not him, you know, just really acrimonious departure.
Yeah.
and you know, how nasty that was when he left. And I think on both sides, I think that was good for both, you know, Favre to put all that to rest, and then also for the Packer fan, Packer Nation to heal and really to take back one of their, you know, their greatest of all time. And I thought, and it was interesting that they called him the greatest Packer of all time.
Mm.
That's going some, because there's been some awful good Green Bay Packers.
They have indeed. Jeff, I remember doing a radio game when I was doing the BBC Radio 5 coverage a few years ago, and it was Brett Favre's return to Lambeau Field with the Minnesota Vikings. And if you want to talk about the most hated of pantomime villains, that day it was ferocious. I mean, it wasn't just that sort of token booing. There was some real, you know, real hatred and real feeling of being hurt behind it from the Packers fans. And I think Favre managed to start to build bridges a couple of years ago at the NFL Honors event around Super Bowl, where he's on stage with Aaron Rodgers. They have a lot of fun with that. And I think this is the outcome that everybody would want to see, because I think, you know, it was a difficult one, wasn't it? Because Favre probably didn't handle everything the best way he should. I thought Aaron Rodgers was the one who handled it the best. He kind of shut up and just let his play do the talking. But you got to look and think, well, there was part, you know, if Brett Favre still wanted to play, and we know what a competitor he is with all those games that he didn't miss for, you know, this Iron Man, you can kind of excuse the fact that, if he wasn't going to play in Green Bay, you can understand why he wanted to play somewhere else, because he just loves the game.
Well, I don't, you know, again, how can you fault a guy for wanting to continue to play? And,
yeah,
you know, he proved that he still had a lot of football in him when he went to, you know, to New York and to Minnesota. But again, you can understand the Packer point of view, and you can understand Teddy Thompson's very, very, well, it had to be a, you know, just an excruciating decision to move on from a guy that was the face of your franchise and so incredibly popular amongst the fan base and entire Packer Nation. And, you know, when he, it really, really was, I think, more Favre than Ted that didn't see eye to eye. And
yeah,
then, you know, then the agent got involved, and then it got public, and then, you know, then it just got nasty. And you have to understand, too, I think, that the Packers and Packer fans and you know, Packer Nation, you know, there's always going to be that kind of intense pride and even maybe a little chip on their shoulder because, you know, they're a city of 200,000 people. They're the only team that's, you know, publicly owned. Mm. I mean, they've got such a long, proud history. And so, you know, for him to turn his back as they viewed it on, you know, Packer Nation.
People just don't do
go
that.
Go out and play. Yeah, so that wasn't the way that Nitschke left. That wasn't the way that Starr left. That wasn't the way that Shannon Sharpe left. That wasn't the way that all of those great Packer players in the past had left. And it was really a difficult pill, a jagged pill for Packer Nation to swallow. But I think all is good now again. And you know, it was like I said, it was wonderful to watch it. It was, you know, I couldn't help but think about Jerry Glanville as I'm watching it, and you know, when they had drafted Favre out of Southern Mississippi, and you know, Jerry saying, Jerry wouldn't even call him by his name, he called him Mississippi. He said, "Hey, Mississippi, Favre asked him one time if he was going to play in the preseason game, and he goes, Mississippi, the only way you're getting in the game is if everybody else is hurt, and maybe even the equipment man." He went from pretty humble beginnings to being one of the greatest players that ever, you know, threw a football in the National Football League.
But to be fair to Jerry, early in those Favre years, he had some Kenny Stabler in him that we were talking about last week. Favre was burning the midnight oil, and I always think it's amusing that the year that Favre won that Super Bowl with the Green Bay Packers, he was the starter and his backup was Jim McMahon. I mean, imagine the celebration there.
Well, you know, Brett Favre early in his career never met a night out that he didn't like. So, you know, he goes from Southern Miss, where he's that kid, you know, just that swashbuckling riverboat gambler. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people got to understand just how little football he really understood when he came to the National Football League, and then he goes into Atlanta, and they're running the run and shoot, or what they called the red gun at the time, and which is very intricate and very disciplined. And, you know, he doesn't have a great technical football background, just has tremendous ability. Mm. And then he goes from, you know, from Mississippi to Buckhead, which is when I say Buckhead, those people that know Atlanta will know what I'm talking about. Buckhead's a very fashionable, cool part of Atlanta. And he got a lot of money and nobody to tell you no. It's pretty easy to get distracted, and he got distracted. Got distracted. But you know what?
He got distracted as a newt.
You know what? Here's the thing too. You talk about this, and this sounds just absolutely like no way. But Favre will admit it. When they first were having meetings and they talked about nickel, okay, you got the nickel in the game. That was a. He asked one of the other quarterbacks, he goes, "Hey, let me ask you a question. What's the nickel? Who are they talking about with this nickel?" And the guy looked at him, I think it was Ty Detmer, looked at him and said, "You're kidding me, right?"
Yeah.
He goes, "No, what are they talking about with the nickel?" So, I mean, that's how far Holmgren had to bring him.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. He's been, Brett Favre has been the personal launching pad for some pretty good coaching careers. You know, if you look at the guys that actually coached him over the course of his career, you know, you got John Gruden,
yep,
Marty Morningwig, Andy Reid, Steve Mariucci. Each of those guys went from being the quarterback coach or working with the offense in Green Bay to head coaching jobs in the National Football League. And I think that's another a bit of the Favre legacy that people don't realize. When he was coached personally by those guys, Gruden, Morningwig, you know, all of those guys all the way through, Andy and, you know, Mariucci, that's pretty good, man. That's a pretty good group of guys that you got out there and kind of carried to head coaching jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's Brett Favre, who made a welcome return to Lambeau Field this past week, in front of 67,000 fans as he was inducted into Green Bay's Hall of Fame. One other piece of news I wanted to touch on, Jeff, Probably actually should mention Pittsburgh signed Cameron Hayward, their defensive end, to a 6-year, $59.2 million deal. He had his best year last year, 7.5 sacks, very strong against the run. One of those 3-4 defensive ends we talked about last week. But Jeff, I want to talk about your guy. Emmanuel Sanders has said that it looks like he's going to play in the slot when Denver go to their 3 wide receiver sets in 2015. We know he's very versatile. We know he's very explosive. How do you think he's going to do? I guess that's the long-term replacement Denver are looking at for Wes Welker.
I think that's a great move.
Yeah.
I think that's a great move. When I had E at SMU, he played slot for us, and that's where he's really dynamic. He is so good inside. It's so tough for people to get their hands on him inside. He creates really a huge matchup challenge against most nickel corners in the NFL. He has a feel for, you know, one of the things you have to be able to do when you play inside and you play in a slot, we talk about you have to be able to run in traffic. And
yeah,
because you're in where the linebackers are, there are more people around you. Some guys don't like playing in there. It's just, you know, you got to be a little tougher. He's fearless. He is absolutely fearless. For a guy that's not very big, he's always been that way. He is, like I say, going to create a tremendous, tremendous matchup challenge inside. He will give you all of the things that Welker gave you on the underneath and the short routes, the little read routes, the option routes. But he'll also be that guy that can get down the middle of cover two. And really, if you play without a safety in the middle of the field, he has the ability to get up the field and really hurt you on vertical routes. So I think that's a great move for Denver and a great move for Emmanuel.
So, Jeff, I was going to ask you about that, because when we look at Wes Welker, or if we say, I don't know, Julian Edelman or Cole Beasley, we look at very savvy players who can work the middle of the field, but maybe they aren't as athletic as Emmanuel is. Has he got the intellect? You say it's part of it's a heart thing as well. You've got to be able to work over the middle, but do you think he's got that ability to find those gaps? I mean, do you think he can do all of that plus be more athletic on top? I mean, could he become one of the best slot receivers in the NFL?
Well, I think he and Beasley both are uniquely trained to play there, and both of those. Now, can you imagine how blessed I was when I'm coaching at SMU, and I got two slots. One's Cole Beasley, and the other's Emmanuel Sanders.
Yeah.
Guys that would go on and, you know, be millionaires in the NFL, great, great NFL players. Well, they were trained inside, and they were trained in a system that really is way, way, way ahead of, you know, the typical, you know, college offense, the spread offense, or even some of the West Coast versions that are in college. These guys understand coverage. They both are extremely smart. They have tremendous football IQs. They understand leverage. They understand coverage. They understand defensive reaction. And all that allows them to play a step faster than most guys can when they get in the slot. Now, when you mention Emmanuel against some of those other guys, and you talk about Edelman and you talk about Wes Welker and those guys, the thing that was lacking in their game was the vertical ability, the ability to run a shake route or a skinny post or, you know, even a corner route against zero coverage and get over the top and make the big, big play. I think that's what Emmanuel will bring inside to Denver. Like I say, I think this will be an opportunity for him to really, really, really take that next step and be one of the elite receivers in the game. I think he's one of the top 100 players in the game right now, certainly, but I think this will give him an opportunity to really hang some numbers, and I'm sure he's also very quarterback-friendly because he has such a high football IQ, and I think Peyton's going to really enjoy this time together with him.
Jeff, we like to educate our listeners along the way. We do pick up new followers all the time. You know, we hear a go route mentioned all the time. We hear skinny post all the time. I actually haven't heard of a shake route all that much. So, could you enlighten us?
Well, a shake is a route that you see on the goal line, and it's like a little corner route. And what it does is it isolates that inside slot player against the nickel corner when there's no safety over the top. And his ability, and it comes from the term shake, to shake that nickel and then beat him up over the top is, you know, where the name of the route comes from. It goes by different names in different systems, but, you know, those isolation routes inside where, you know, again, this is one of the great things that Denver has is what do you do with your safety? If you're going to play a single safety defense and now you've got to push him one way or the other. If you push him over Demaryius Thomas, then you're exposed inside with your nickel corner and nobody in the middle of the field. That's where Emmanuel, as a college player, and I anticipate he'll do the same things in the NFL, was just you couldn't cover him in there. Mm. He just is so slippery, and he has, you know, he has the ability to. He's not the fastest guy. I don't want to, you know, give you this impression that he's a world class sprinter inside, because he's not. But he has great competitive speed, and he understands how to break down a defensive back's technique, get into his cushion, move him, open his hips so that he can break back across his face. And, you know, with his long arms, one of the things that when you meet the kid that impresses you about him physically, when you meet him, even though he's only 6 feet tall, 5'11", 6 feet tall, he's got really long arms and big hands. So he has a bigger catching range than most inside receivers have. I saw him work out the other day in his off-season program, and I'm telling you, he is in great shape. And he is, again, the kid grew up in a small town, Texas. He was a rodeo kid as a young kid. So toughness and work, you know, are not new to him. So I really think he's going to have a breakout year in Denver.
See, Jeff, we had that shake route when I was playing, but it was just called a wobble route. You get all those bad body parts moving all over the place. Defensive back doesn't know which way to look. He just turns away. Right, let's look at let's move on.
It doesn't matter how you get open, just get open.
Get open, exactly. Just get the ball in your hands in the end zone. We're going to look at 4-3 defensive ends then now. And look at our top five and some of the emerging talent that's around the NFL. But Jeff, from an X's and O's point of view, you gave a great explanation of a 3-4 defensive end in last week's podcast. So what is a 4-3 defensive end? What are the differences between the two?
Well, I think the biggest difference is these guys, although most of them do drop a little bit into coverage, because almost every NFL system now has the ability to drop an end into coverage. But these guys make their money. They're going to get paid. They're going to earn that big salary because of their ability to get after the passer and rush off the edge. When we say the edge, we're talking about rush against the tackles. These are the guys that keep the offensive tackles, you know, up at night with those sleepless nights thinking, oh, my God, I got to go against him 70 snaps on Sunday. Football parlance, these guys, and this is a position that's changed over time. You know, these guys used to be 280, 290-pound guys. Now you're seeing a trend in the NFL where they're starting to thin out a little bit. But typically, what do these guys have? They have length. They have an incredible first step. And so much of winning in pass rush is that first step up the field, your ability to get hip-to-hip with the pass rusher, to open his shoulders and get him to turn so that you can work a move on him. They're typically guys who have great, what we call, hand skills, because a lot of the ability to get off an offensive tackle is your ability to work a hand technique against his hand. And they're relentless, just absolutely relentless. Just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And in every single guy on my list, one of the things I liked about him was the fact that they had what we call a motor. They just play fast and hard all the time.
We'll go through our lists then, Jeff. And I think this was actually a really tough list to pull together, because I don't think there's any clear leader. I think if you told me, I don't know, one of three or four players who are number one on your list, I could buy that argument. And I think that's, you know, there's probably 10 very good ones around the NFL. So to come up with a list of five, or I've actually got six because I've got two in a tie, is very difficult. But we'll give it a go anyway. So I'm going to start number five. I've got Everson Griffin of the Minnesota Vikings. I think he's come on in the last couple of years. Again, that first step quickness that you talk about is there with his game. 12 sacks last season. So I think Everson Griffin is actually an arrow up kind of guy. I've got a tie then at number four. I couldn't really separate Jerry Hughes, who I know you kind of had him in a different role last week, but I've got Jerry Hughes and Mario Williams together from the Buffalo Bills. Number three, I've got Robert Quinn of the St. Louis Rams. Again, I think he's very, very intense, has that refusal to be blocked, and that's something you always look for on top of all the technical side of the position. Number two, I've got Michael Bennett from Seattle. And I think the biggest reason is because of something we've alluded to in previous podcasts, that scheme or that position versatility. So he can play on the end, but when it's a passing down, you could line him up inside. And I think that's huge. And then I think I've got top of the pile, but again, I think this is very disputable and could be disputed. I've got Cameron Wake of the Miami Dolphins. So I don't have Jason Pierre-Paul. I'm concerned about the fireworks hand injury. I'm sort of waiting to see how Greg Hardy comes back for the Dallas Cowboys. So that's my five or six.
I'm going to tell you something. I really agree with you on one hand in that this is a very deep position in the National Football League.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain positions, quarterback certainly is the one we talk about the most, but where you just, there aren't enough guys to go around. Well, you know, when you look at your top five, Neil, and you got two guys from the same team in your top five.
Yeah.
What's that say about the depth around the league? And I think that, you know, as I did this exercise, I mean, it was almost surprising to me the number of guys that, you know, are out there that really are, you know, really, really good pass rushers and edge players in the NFL today. I'm going to give you mine, and it's interesting because I think we're pretty close on a lot of things. I thought Griffin was my five. You know, the thing I liked about him is his toughness and his durability. He got to play 900 snaps. I mean, he played more than any other defensive end in the league last year, and he had 40 quarterback hurries to go with those 12 sacks that you talked about. So he's consistent.
So it's disrupting, Jeff.
Getting,
it's not always about the sacks,
he's
is
consistent.
It?
Absolutely, because, you know, the really good quarterbacks are not going to take sacks, right? They're going to get the ball out of their hand, even if they have to throw it away, rather than take disaster plays or bad plays. And the fact that he had 40 quarterback hurries, I think, was indicative of a great pass rush ability. He's got that first step you look for. He can bend the corner. And I really think that he's going to continue to grow and blossom in Mike Zimmer's system in Minnesota. Mm. So I gave him my number five pick. I went with Ziggy Ansah at number four.
Yep.
And this is a guy that fans are going to see when in Wembley. The kid, here's a kid that goes to BYU as a basketball player and really doesn't come to football until, you know, with 2 years left to play in college football, you know, his college career. He's older. He's 27 years old. I thought a lot of people thought that the Lions really reached when they took him in the draft as a first rounder, but he's proven a lot of people wrong. The kid can get after the quarterback. He's still learning to play the game. There's still parts of his game that are not refined or finished, but I'm going to tell you something. From a pure athletic standpoint, when it comes to getting to the quarterback, that guy had to get into my top five.
It's going to be on him a lot more now, Jeff, that Ndamukong Suh isn't there.
Yeah, he's going to have to take that next step in his career because he's going to be the focal point now. And, you know, again, without Fairley, without Sue, there's going to be more pressure on him to get to the quarterback. But I think he's up for it, and I think it's a great opportunity this fall for NFL UK fans to watch him live at Wembley. Yeah, my number three is Robert Quinn. You know, the out of the Rams, you know, he had that monster year in 2013 where he had 19 sacks, dropped off a little bit last year, but still had 46 tackles. So he's a guy that can both, you know, play the run and rush the passer. Some of these guys aren't interested particularly in playing the run very much, but Robert Quinn plays every part of the game, a relentless guy. And, again, he also forced five fumbles. So there's a playmaker. And, again, a guy who really, over the course of his career now, has proven that he was worthy of that number one draft pick status that he had. My number two is Cameron Wake.
Yep.
Here's a kid that comes out of Penn State and has to come to the CFL to prove to people he can do it. He came up here, rushed the passer well for a couple years with the BC Lions, went back to Miami, and just really has proven to be one of the most dynamic players in the National Football League off the edge. A nightmare guy for offensive tackles because he has such great quickness, and he's got great strength and has the ability, what we call suppleness, the ability to move his body, change his body positions, and hard to hit for an offensive tackle with his hands. So a relentless, relentless player that I think, again, gives the Dolphins a special, special guy. I really think he's the key to that Dolphin defense. And now imagine him playing with, you know, with Sue inside of him. So I look for him to have another big year. My number one guy is my guy. You know, the kid I recruited out of high school in Houston and signed to come to Louisiana Tech, Michael Bennett. Let me just tell you this Michael Bennett story. Hmm. When I was recruiting Michael, I came to do a home visit, and Ms. Bennett brought me into the house, and I said, "Where's Mike?" And she said, "He's out in the backyard." It was dark out. It was, you know, what we call home visit, which is you go in and you talk to the parents and the family about why it's important that their son would come to your school. And it's nighttime after dinner, and Michael's out in the backyard, and he had taken a mattress from his sister's bed and tied it around a tree in the backyard, and he was out in the backyard by himself working pass rush moves against a tree.
Wow.
Now, that's as a 17-year-old kid. And he came into the National Football League as an undrafted player, was on the practice roster, got plucked off the practice roster by Tampa, started to blossom there, went back to Seattle, and has turned into, in my opinion now, the top defensive end in the league, because he can do, like you said, Neil, so many things. He can play inside. He can play outside. He's great against the pass. He's outstanding against the run. He's a relentless player. He's just now starting to get to the prime of his career. You know, he's just a really, really fine football player. And I'm really happy for him because, you know, I've watched that kid, like I said, since he was a, you know, a 17-year-old junior in high school and you know, at Katie Taylor High School in Houston. And I think he's a, you know, the best all-around player. And to be honest with you, I got a little soft spot for him because every time we go to the Super Bowl and Seattle's playing in it, we get a chance to reunite.
Catch
he
up.
Gives me a big hug, and he hasn't changed a bit since. He's still as goofy as he was at 17, too.
Good. Well, I mean, and Cowboys defensive line coach Leon Lett told me last week, he was like, give me those guys that are scheme versatile, guys I can move along the defensive line. Those are the kind of players that coaches like. So that's why Michael Bennett is top of Jeff's list. Jeff, I'm just looking down the, you know, I compiled a long list of others. I mean, and it is deep. I mean, a couple of young ones that jump out to me. I think Junior Gallette of the New Orleans Saints. He's had 22 sacks over the past 2 years. And I actually like Olivier Vernon of the Miami Dolphins, who I think could as well benefit. He had a 10-sack season a couple of years ago. You've got Charles Johnson in Carolina. Cliff Avril still can do the business in terms of that sudden, quick first step. So I think you're absolutely right. This is a deep group. There's a big question mark on Jason Pierre-Paul. It's got to be, well, you need to show me, isn't it, Jeff?
I think so. And again, when you talk about the depth at this group, I actually put a couple guys into a group I call the movie out, the series out, the Transformers, you know, where the guys morph into one thing or another thing. So these are my Transformers because they're the guys that can go from that 4-3 end to that 3-4 outside linebacker and not miss a step. Guys like DeMarcus Ware, Vaughn Miller, Ninkovich and Chandler Jones in New England, Jerry Hughes, Julius Peppers, all of those guys. I mean, how do you not have Julius Peppers on your list?
Yeah.
But then you say, well, what is he?
He
last year showed that he showed as an outside backer in Green Bay. He's a dynamic player. And then I agree with you. The best of the rest to me, I like Gallette. I think he gives Rob Ryan that flexible pass rusher that he can move all over the place, which is so important in his scheme. Robert Ayers. You know, Robert Ayers is only a rotational player, but still, you know, you look at him and think, wow, Charles Johnson, I agree. Cliff Avril, oldie but a goodie, can still get to the passer off the edge. I think he's kind of a one-dimensional player now. And again, Mario Williams is the one that just look at and I go, you talk about physical skill.
Oh, yeah.
You talk about ability. You know, there are very few that have ever played that have the physical tools that he has. And whenever he wants to be a great player, he can be a great player. It's just that you watch him play and it seems like he doesn't really want to be one all the time. I agree with you on Pierre Paul. You're going to have to show me now coming back off that. People talk about the fact that he had the damage to the three fingers and lost a finger and all that, the parts of three fingers. I think there's going to be as much psychological damage with this thing as you know, the embarrassment of how it happened, the situation that now the acrimony that's created with the team, He wouldn't see his teammates for a number of days. I just want to see how he comes off of that mentally. And then I agree with you. Greg Hardy is kind of, you know, that guy out there that what's he going to be like when he comes back now? He hasn't played a year. It'll be a year and a year and some games before he gets back. But when the Kraken was the Kraken at Carolina, he was a special, special player. So Cowboy Nation is really hoping that he can come back. He could be a critical piece to that defense, which, you know, has gotten so much better in the last couple of years. But, you know, hopefully, he continues to play. I like these young guys. Mm. I like Devin Taylor. You know, of the Lions, again, a 6'7", 267, raw athletic guy. Eugene Sims at the Rams. I agree with you, Olivier Vernon. NFL UK fans, watch this kid. Mm. Watch this kid. And I think he's going to go even another step now that he's playing with better players around him. You know, and, Andre Branch at the Jaguars is another guy that you don't talk about in a great deal, but I think has skills off the edge.
Jeff, it's interesting.
That's a great group, Neil. Yeah. I agree with you.
One more point on this, then we'll move on to the mailbag. These lists are not actually that easy to do on the defensive side of the ball because you don't, it's not as clear cut. I mean, for the most part on offense, you know, an offensive tackle is an offensive tackle. A running back is a running back. Yes, you'll get, is Jimmy Graham a tight end or a receiver? Or what is Julius Thomas when he's split out wide? You know, is he a tight end lined up out wide or is he a big wide receiver? So there's a little bit of clouding on the offensive side of the ball. But defense, you're right. We don't know whether DeMarcus Ware's a defensive end or an outside linebacker. We don't know whether, Jamie Collins of New England can play multiple positions. I mean, that's, I guess, the way the league has gone, hasn't it, Jeff? And I guess that's the whole point on defense. You're trying to disguise stuff.
Well, I tell you what has happened now with the rules changes and the offensive changes and, you know, all these crazy things you're seeing. When I say crazy, I'm talking about different things you're seeing in the National Football League offensively, it's really forced defensive coaches to turn the page and to think outside the box. This past week, we lost one of the great defensive minds ever, Bill Arnsparger, who was really the father of situational football on defense.
Yeah, substitutions.
Where they were situationally subbed, you know. Exactly. I mean, A.J. Duhay, who's a friend of mine, played for him at Miami, and A.J. talked about how he came out of LSU just a raw, long pass rusher and really wasn't much else. And Arns found a place for him in that system where he could go in and be that kind of hybrid player way back before anybody ever even thought about that. You know, the 53 defense where, you know, Bob Matheson became a guy who, and Bob Matheson was an average player, quote, average player, that Arns saw something in and said, what you do extremely well. I'm just going to put you in that situation and let you do it as opposed to, well, you're a middle linebacker and you have to do these things and you have to play on these downs and all that. So that it's, you know, offensive football has changed what defensive coaches and the job descriptions, if you will, of the players that play defense. You freaking offensive guys, Neil, it never stops with you. You got all the rules in your favor. Everybody wants to be on offense. You just keep making life miserable for us defensive
there
guys.
There you go. And we're going to move to offense next week, Jeff. Let's do the top five offensive linemen in the NFL. All right?
You couldn't stay off of offense. You couldn't stay off
couldn't
offense
stay on
for
def-
more than a week.
I couldn't stay off on defense for much longer. I was getting a bit antsy. So we'll throw them all together, though. We're going to do centers, guards, and tackles together. So the top five offensive linemen, regardless of position, we'll do that next week. Let's take some questions in the mailbag. Good one to start us off here from Jack Miller, who says, cricket and rugby now show the conversation between the replay booth and the field officials. Would the NFL do it to help make decisions like Des Bryant's catch in the playoffs last year clearer for those in the ground and at home? Jeff, I actually don't know how the NFL would feel about that, but I think that's a fantastic idea because the one thing that I think frustrates fans is a lack of clarity and a lack of knowing what the officials were thinking. I think if you could hear the conversation going on between the field official and the booth, at least you'd have some idea of what they were thinking about and how they reached their decision.
Well, I agree with you on one part of that, that I do think that the fans, and I know that as a fan, you know, when we sit and watch the games, it's the the cloak of secrecy that is veiled around this whole thing. The guy sticks his head underneath this curtain, and you know, the fan really doesn't understand what's going on, the process that's going on. I don't think that's ever going to happen, because I don't think the league and the officials association and will ever open themselves up to that kind of scrutiny. Those conversations, I think, will continue to be guarded, if you will. I just officials are under so much scrutiny to begin with now, probably more scrutiny than they've ever been, because of the fact that there's so many camera angles in the stadium and all of that, that I think to open up their conversations over a call would be, I think the fans would enjoy it. I just can't see that happening, at least in the near future, because I just think they're not ready for, the Officials Association isn't ready for that.
All right. Another question from Tobias Patterson, who says, with the Deflategate footballs selling for £28,000 a piece, do you have any valuable memorabilia? If so, what? Well, Tobias, it's a great question. But Jeff, when you're actually in the business of reporting and covering the NFL, you don't, you know, you may get the odd photo where you're interviewing somebody, but you know, you don't really go around sort of grabbing autographs as much as people might think. I mean, you're kind of there to cover you know, the NFL and the stories. The only thing I can think of that I've got is, you remember the Super Bowl in New Orleans where Tom Brady won his first one for the Patriots? So Patriots against the Rams, it was the first one after 9/11. I was working for NFL UK and I had an allocated ticket to that game. And I also was in the press box. And I remember, obviously, a colleague of yours for many years, Tony Allen, was looking for an extra ticket. And I kept calling Tony the night before the game. Couldn't get in touch with Tony out in New Orleans. So I've got a ticket that never was used. So it was never torn apart. The stub is, everything is still intact on that ticket. And that, I know for a fact, whenever they announced that that was a sold out Super Bowl, I know there was one seat empty, because I couldn't sell it on the black market. I couldn't get it to anyone who would use it. And I've still got the ticket to this day. But I don't know if we collect that much memorabilia, do we?
You know what? I don't really at all. And then as the question got asked, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I think the coaching manuals and notes and all of the stuff that Coach Vermeil sent me when he was on hiatus, that 10 or 12 years when he was not coaching in the NFL after he got his burnout in Philadelphia, before he went back to St. Louis and won a Super Bowl, that probably has, at least in the collector category, probably has the most value of any physical thing that I possess. I have a tremendous amount of priceless memories that certainly from my time doing this. But you know, again, if you came to my house, Neil, you're not even gonna, you wouldn't know if I was a plumber or you know, an electrician or a football coach, because I don't have anything football in my house. I just, you know, again, that's something I've never done. Maybe I should have, I guess, if that thing's going for £28,000.
Yeah, no, I'm the same as you, Jeff. I don't have anything sort of on display in my house. I have, you know, I've never been, I've got my Twitter picture is me and Joe Montana. I think that's one of, probably the only player I've ever sort of asked to have a picture with. You know, the other things I kind of treasure are when I've been able to host fan rallies and things like that, and people have sent me pictures where I'm interviewing players on stage. So nothing's posed, but I think they're nice things that I'll put away, and you know, they're kind of stockpiled and they're hidden away, but they'll be nice things to pull out when I'm sitting by the fireplace and it's all said and done, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's the same thing. I have numerous bowl rings and championship rings that I've given away, you know, given them all to my children. And I think the only one I have left now is the 12-0 undefeated team in Hawaii that went to the Sugar Bowl. That may be the only ring that I still have in my possession. I, all the other championship rings and bowl rings I've given away. To me, those are things that you know, other people probably have more, identify with more or find more pleasure in. So I'm more than happy to, you know, to pass those things on.
Jeff, when we're too old and too gray to be doing TV anymore, let's load up a minibus, with all our prized possessions, drive around the UK and tell people what the stories behind each of them is. They're boring, stupid, but we'll have a great time.
You know, I think it's that's kind of what we're doing right now.
Probably.
You know what I mean? We're
minus the minibus, right? Listen, one more question.
Exactly.
Let's do one more question just to wrap up, and then we'll finish this week's Inside the Huddle. And this one has been asked a few times, Jeff, and you're uniquely placed to answer this. So Phil King asks, what would the result be if you took the best college football team against the worst NFL team?
You know what? This is a Phil, what a great question. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to go back in my football history book, and there used to be a game played in the summer.
It was the one that started the season,
before I believe it was before training camp started.
Yeah.
Or it may have been during training camp, where they would get the college all-stars would get together. The best college players that were entering the NFL would get together, and they would play a pro team. And it was called the College All-Star Game. They used to play it in Chicago.
Jeff, they played the NFL champions from the year before.
Exactly. And I don't remember it being a great success story for the College All-Stars. You know, I think there's a lot of talk every year about that, about, you know, is this Ohio State team as good as, you know, whatever the poorest NFL team is, or could Oregon play, you know, the Chargers, or, you know, that's fun stuff to speculate about. But let me just put it this way. College football is a game that's played on Saturday afternoon by boys. Mm. Pro football is a war that's waged on Sunday afternoon by men. And that's the best way I can put it. There is such a huge difference between if you just look at it from a analytical standpoint, what do they say? 2% of the college players ever make it in the National Football League.
Right.
Well, if those numbers are true, and they're historic numbers over time, that's not just last year, that's over history. Well, those 98% of the guys that are playing college football will only watch an NFL game. They'll never play in an NFL game or pro football game. So obviously it is very, very difficult to see a college football team ever competing on the stage with an NFL team. And again, Neil, you know from having been in training camps, been, you know, up close and personal with these guys, that, you know, every one of these guys that's playing in the NFL was the best player there on their college football team, or one of the best players on their college football team. So, you know, I don't think the college teams could compete with pro football players.
No, and just to wrap up, you know, I said it last time I was out at the mini camps in June. There's third and fourth stringers in the NFL, Jeff, that are making plays that just make your jaw drop. Those are the third and fourth stringers.
It is so difficult to make a pro football team. I mean, it is really, really difficult to make a pro football team. And there are far more guys out there with ability that aren't playing than there are guys with ability that aren't playing. And that's, I mean, you know, it's one of those deals that, you know, if you got the ability, no guarantee you can make it in the National Football League. If you don't have the ability, pretty good guarantee that you're not going to make it in the National Football League. So, you know, let's enjoy the college game for what it is. I think the fanfare, the fact that nobody ever graduated from the New York Jets, and they did from Rutgers or SMU, or, you know, that college spirit, you know, that's not to dampen the college game or put the college game down. It's a great, college football is a great institution, but the NFL and pro football are, you're talking about special, special guys.
I actually don't think any Jets fans ever graduated either, Jeff.
Uh-oh, here we go. Jets Nation UK better rise up now, because Neil's throwing that gauntlet down. Once you're a Finn fan, you can't, there's just no backing away, is there?
And I say that as a man who never even went to university. How about that? Educated at the University of Life, School of Hard Knocks. Jeff, good stuff, man. Great. Well, next week we'll do those top five offensive linemen. This has been Inside the Huddle in association with SkySports.com and NFL UK. Until next week, say goodbye, Coach.
Hello.